You're listening to STEMcast, brought to you by McGill iGEM.
Today on STEMcast, we're here with Dr. Nagisa Mahmoodi, who is a biogeochemist at McGill University. She works on microbes in the deep ocean and in space and in other extreme environments. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad we could finally make this happen.
Yeah. All right. To start off, could you tell us a little bit about your research and what you sort of do in your lab?
Sure. So our lab is a geomicrobiology lab. And so we study microbes in the ocean. So that includes in the water column, in the sediment. And we are primarily interested in thinking about what they're eating in the ocean. And so we have multiple projects looking at that question with different implications. So some of them are very applied, thinking about, can microbes eat petroleum oil and how quickly can they do it? How can we make them do it faster? And then thinking also all the way from, you know, oil spills to very basic questions, thinking about some of the ocean worlds in our solar system and the organic compounds that are there and whether microbes could eat those. So it's really the whole sort of gamut ranging from astrobiology in life in places we don't know, all the way to thinking about how to use microbes, you know, to harness them for our own use.
Okay, that's super cool. Can I ask how you sort of got to where you are in your research career and like what inspired you to pick this as your research interest?
So I started off in my undergrad in biology at the University of Toronto. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew that I didn't want to do medical school, but I went into biology anyway. So I mostly took cell and molecular biology classes. And so a lot of my classes were thinking about cells and, you know, eukaryotic human cells as well as bacterial cells, but it was like a very human and health focused perspective. And then in my, one of my senior years, I took a upper level microbiology class where we spent one day on microbes in the environment. And I thought that was fascinating. I was like, we've spent all this time talking about cells in our bodies, but there's actually way more cells outside of our bodies in things like seawater and soil and sediment. And so I just found that really interesting, as taking a lot of these ideas and concepts that I had already learned, but thinking about them in the context of the environment. So when I finished my undergrad, I then decided, okay, I want to study microbes, but I want to do it in the environment. And so I went and worked with someone who was looking at microbes at different contaminated sites, like petroleum contaminated sites. And then a lot of my graduate work was trying to understand whether the microbes at these sites were actually eating and helping to clean up the contaminants. And if not, why weren't they doing it? And how could we potentially make them do it? And so that's how I sort of started on this path. I did more and more work in marine environments. Part of that was due to the fact that there was a very large oil spill during my PhD, the Deepwater Horizon spill. And so suddenly there was all of this work in the realm of, you know, the ocean and marine samples and sediments. And so it was just sort of like luck that that spill happened while I was working on that. And so, yeah, so I sort of transitioned more into marine environments at that time, and then just sort of kept, I don't know, sort of working towards that. And then sort of the natural progression for me as a researcher was I had spent a lot of time thinking about, are microbes in the ocean eating oil? And then I thought, okay, well, what do they eat when they don't eat oil? Like when there is no oil, what do they eat? And that's like a primary research focus of mine now, is thinking about how microbes eat natural organic matter in the ocean. And they do that and they release CO2, and that affects how much carbon the ocean can store and how much CO2 is released. And so it's a big important question for the global carbon cycle, but it just sort of naturally came out of thinking about it, came out of doing the work I was doing. So it was not really like a clear path. It was sort of like, I like biology, let me see what'll happen. And then just, you know, discovering microbes in the environment through a class I had taken.
Okay. So now that you have your own lab here at McGill, what does a typical day look like for you?
Okay. So that's one of the things that I love about what I do as a researcher. Every day is completely different. And it's like this when you're a grad student and when you're a postdoc and even when you're a professor. It's just every day can be very, very different. So some days I'm writing and thinking, so working on papers, working on grants, you know, sitting at a computer and actually like writing and reading papers. I don't get to the lab as much as possible, but I still try to train my students and work with them. So, and if something's broken, I go in there to try to help fix it. So some days I could be in the lab, like wearing a lab coat with gloves on, fixing something, or again, training someone. Then we also have a lot of student meetings. So we have one-on-one meetings where we look at their data and think about things, or maybe someone's read an interesting paper or a new technique. You know, some days are just filled with talking about science. So it really varies. And then there's always like the unexpected fires that might come up where like somebody needs something. Like yesterday, one of my students was like, we need more dry ice. They don't have it in the building. We normally get it. And so I'm emailing people and trying to help them locate it. Or there's always things like that sort of happening in the background, because there's all of these projects happening that require certain things and chemicals and all of these things in the lab. But it's really variable, right? Because like when you do research, the way we do research, which is laboratory based, you spend some of your time in the lab. And again, every day is probably different. You might be doing a different technique or starting an experiment, ending an experiment, and then you have to analyze that data. So sometimes you might just be looking at spreadsheets and then you have to write about the data. So it can be really variable. Sometimes I also teach. So this past semester, I taught astrobiology, but yeah, most of my time is taken up with like lab related and research related things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I also want to add, I took Environment 202 last year when you taught it.
Oh, thank you. That's a really fun class to teach too, because you can teach it with people from biology. And it's so nice because all of our expertise sort of gets to come together.
Yeah, that sort of leads into another question that I was going to ask. You seem to do a lot of like very interdisciplinary research. So touching the fields of like chemistry, biochemistry, microbiology, environment, like a ton of different things. And also like chemical engineering with petroleum. Do you feel that your research can be applied to all of these different fields? And what's it like sort of learning pieces of all of these to make your research questions like substantial?
That's a really good question. And that is something that's actually, I would say, a characteristic, not necessarily in terms of just my research program, but anyone that I think does research related to, say, microbes in the environment. And the reason is because, you know, there's all of these processes going on because you're thinking about how a cell interacts with all of these other things. And so like in my case, you know, I'm thinking about cells and what they're eating, but they're in an ocean. So sometimes we need to talk to oceanographers to figure out like something about waves or temperature or how much oxygen is there and how that water gets turned over. And I'm, you know, not an oceanographer by training. And so we have to work with people who are trained oceanographers. Same with working with people who do, say, I don't know, geology. Like if we want to know more about the rocks in the environment where the microbes are, we have to talk to people who actually study that, because again, we don't really know very much about rocks. So I guess it could be, you know, you could look at that in two ways. You could look at it as like, oh, your research is not necessarily reliant, but like you really have to work with other people. But I've actually really liked that. I like the fact that I get to work with people who do very different things than I do, because they can really bring a different perspective to my research. So I collaborate with people who are geologists. I collaborate with physicists. I collaborate with biochemists that do mostly medical work, and maybe they're studying enzymes, but in the context of like antibiotic resistance, but they can help me with an enzyme in the ocean. And so it's, I think, a really key part of my research and doing this kind of work is, you know, working with these other people to really get a holistic picture of, say, the environment these microbes are in and what they might be doing. It's really, I think, a plus. You know, some people might say like, okay, then we turn into this like jack of all trades, but I think it's good because we know a little bit about all these different things. And, you know, I've learned more about topics that I may never have. We just started a project with a physicist here at McGill thinking about modeling solar flux on early Earth and how that would affect microbial life. And I knew nothing about solar life. I didn't even know that. I mean, I guess I probably read that solar flux changes once the star is formed. But, you know, it's so far out of my area of expertise. So for me, I like it because it just keeps things very new and fresh, because I'm constantly like working with people that know so much more than I do about certain topics.
Do you think that that's part of what motivates you to stay in academia and keep teaching students of the next generation these all these different interdisciplinary values that you've learned throughout the years of your work?
I don't know if it's my motivation for staying in academia. I think it's definitely a plus because I don't get bored. I'm always learning. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like I'm still, you know, you would think like, oh, I've done this for 15 or 20 years. I know everything. It gets boring, but it doesn't, because we'll work with a new lab that's, say, looking at the structures of enzymes. And I don't have any experience doing that. And I don't know much about it, but I, at the same time, still get to learn and do it. So yeah, I don't know if it's my motivation for staying in academia, but I definitely try to instill this with my students as well. Like, I always send them to meetings that are very interdisciplinary, so they get to interact with people from all these different disciplines, because I think it ultimately makes our work better. You know, they may get feedback from someone at a poster, at a talk, that's like, hey, did you think about X or Y? And it might be something we didn't think about because we don't know much about that. So yeah, so it's definitely something important. I don't know how much like of an overall motivator it is, but I think it's definitely, like, for me, I feel very lucky to be in this field of like geomicrobiology, environmental microbiology, where you're sort of forced to collaborate and learn from all of these scientists from different disciplines.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So in terms of like what goes on in your lab, it seems like there's a lot of like talking to very, very different people. So what are some of the projects that different grad students or undergrads are like doing actively in your lab right now?
Sure. So I can talk about, like, for example, so every person in my lab has their own project. Every project is different. And sometimes it's based on what the student is interested in. Sometimes it's based on what I just got a grant on. And in that sort of like variation of projects, the other thing that's really unique about working on microbes in the environment is you can do it in different ways. So what I mean is that some of it can involve a lot of lab experiments where you're like physically setting up experiments, you're growing microbes, but a lot of it can even involve like computational work, right? You could like sequence a bunch of stuff and look at those sequences. And so a lot of the differences in the projects and what we do are also tailored to the student's background and what they're interested in. So I have a student right now who's looking at some really, really deep marine sediments. So these are like sediments that are collected, like, I think they're like 200 meters below the seafloor. So very, very deep. And the water depth is like 2,200 meters. So we're talking like 2.4 kilometers from the surface of the earth. And we're looking at sort of different energy sources and carbon sources that microbes are consuming in those sediments. And we're actually doing experiments where we take these sediments that we got through a research cruise from this site, these deep sediments, and we're putting them under different conditions, and we're measuring whether we can see these different energy sources that microbes might be eating. So it's a very like lab intensive project. It's very like chemistry focused. I have another student right now, for example, that is very interested in kelp and looking at the interactions between microbes and kelp. And he's growing kelp and doing work to, you know, sort of like physically swab kelp leaves and then sequence the microbes that are there. So it's less experiments and more like growing kelp and then actually dealing with a lot of sequencing data. And then lastly, I have another student, for example, right now, who's working on understanding the evolution of these specific enzymes on early Earth and thinking about when they would have evolved. So these are enzymes that we know are really important for breaking down nutrients in the ocean, like in our modern ocean. So they're very, very important for sort of the cycling of nutrients. And we're trying to think about when did these enzymes evolve? And how would they have affected the evolution of other organisms that would have appeared at that time?
Okay, yeah, cool. So you mentioned your lab and like you do a lot of, or like your lab does like in lab work, but you seem to be investigating things that are in the natural environment. So when right. It comes to a project that is like the first one you mentioned with the sediments from under the seafloor, how would you go about getting those samples and testing them in the lab?
Yeah, so we test a lot of stuff in the lab. And one of the reasons for that is because in the environment, things are very dynamic, right? Things are constantly changing. So if we were to just go into these systems and just try to make measurements, it's often really hard to know why things are happening the way they are, because so many things are changing at once. So what we often like to do is take samples, bring them back to our lab, and then do very controlled experiments where we have controls and then we change some sort of variable, right? And so the way we get these samples is, so the ones we have that are very deep, that's through this international program called the International Ocean Discovery Program. It's called IODP for short. It's a big sort of international effort to study subsurface environments, subsurface marine environments. And so I got involved with that because one of my previous collaborators was the chief scientist on that cruise. And also, when they have those cruises, you can literally sign up for the mailing list and they say, hey, we've got a cruise going out to, like, I don't know where, like off the coast of Japan or something. And then you actually write a very short proposal saying, I would like to go on the cruise, or I would like samples, and this is what I would do. So anybody can really apply to get the samples. You just have to say what you're going to do with it, and then they review it, and they say yes or no. When you do this kind of work, you are surrounded by people that go on ships and collect samples. And so oftentimes, if we want samples, someone will say, oh, I'm going on a cruise to some place, maybe off the Pacific, or I might know of people that go on a lot of cruises, and I will email them and say, hey, we really want to do some experiments with some deep sea water. We're looking to test this question. Is there any chance you're going on a ship anytime soon? And can you collect some water for us and send it to us? So it's really just like a combination of hearing about something or knowing it, or asking someone, but it's just relying on this network that I've developed over the past, you know, like 5+ years.
That's actually super cool. I didn't realize that there were cruises that specifically did that. And I didn't realize that researchers themselves could actually go on those.
Yeah. So my students go on cruises. I always like to send students on cruises, even though we do a lot of lab work, just because I feel like once you are on the ship and you see the ocean and you see how the samples are collected, it gives you sort of a different perspective than just like being behind a bench or behind a computer analyzing the data. So like one of my students went on a cruise to the Arctic Ocean. I've sent two of them on short cruises to the St. Lawrence. One of them will go on a cruise to the Pacific. So yeah, they're always also, not always, but like I always try to give them experiences as well if they're interested to go on a ship and sort of like, you know, get that experience. But there are other labs that are always, you know, their work is really observational. So there are labs that are very frequently going on research cruises. I would say like we're very much on the low end of it. We really like rely on others and collaborate with others. But yeah, it's really fun and exciting, I think, for students to just sort of have that change of scenery.
Do you have any like cool stories from cruises that you've been on, or like what was your favorite one?
So I haven't been on that many, actually. I've been on like 3. The cruises are, so this is the funny thing is like whenever I tell people that I do like ocean work and we're on cruises, people think it's like really exciting, but it can actually be very boring. So do you know what I mean? You're like on the ship and all you see around you is just blue water. You know, it can be exciting because you're on the ship with all of these other scientists. But for example, one time I went on a cruise and there was really bad weather. And if there's bad weather, they're not going to collect samples. They're just going to wait until like the bad weather passes. And that could be like 12, 24 hours. So you're kind of just like lingering around the ship. There might or might not be good Wi-Fi at the time. So you're really just like reading or watching movies or trying to get work done. So it's not really like that exciting. It is, I think, if you're doing, say, there's like a bunch of cruises that happen now where they're looking at like hydrothermal vents, and they'll send, you know, like different things down, and they'll have like images coming up of the vents and worms and like really exciting images. I haven't been on one of those cruises, but I know people who go. So I think those are super exciting. But I think I've been on like cruises that are like good, but they're like relatively boring and nothing exciting has happened.
So you talk about these cruises that you've been on. Are there any specific areas right now or in the past that are often monitored in terms of collecting samples?
Yeah, so there's a few areas that are often like a lot of cruises happen in them. So the place where we got the really deep samples from, that place is called Guaymas Basin. It's in the Gulf of California. It's a very interesting site. microbially. There's these really cool thick microbial mats at the bottom, and it's a site that is naturally heated. There's hydrothermal heating. So there's been a ton of cruises that have gone out to Guaymas. The other sites that are often really well studied as well, where people go, is like the sites where there's vents, right? So there's different sites in the Pacific and as well as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge where people have gone back and done cruises again and again and again, because there's really interesting chemistry happening there. So my student Sam is going to supposed to go on a cruise next spring, and that's to the East Pacific Rise, which also is a vent site. And that one, I believe, like, there's been a bunch of cruises there in the past.
This is sort of a question that comes out of reading your paper on marine oil biodegradation. If you're looking at areas where there are oil spills, how do you get the data like before and after the spill? And are you sort of limited in regards to what data already exists when you're monitoring these type of things?
You're not limited. So so my only experiences with the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, like I'm not old enough to know what happened with like the Exxon Valdez spill, which is the other well-known site. But typically there's no limitations in terms of like getting the data. Actually, usually what happens is when a spill happens, there's like a ton of money and resources being pumped at that time to try to control the spill, to try to study the spill. And so oftentimes there's, you know, all of these resources that go into going into that area right away and making measurements and collecting samples. And then, you know, once the oil enters that area, collecting samples afterward. So yeah, it really just depends on the site, but at least with like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, there was tons and tons of data, lots of groups mobilized really quickly. And so there was really good measurements of like, what is the background concentration of oil? And I say that because like the Gulf of Mexico has a ton of natural oil seeps. So there is like a baseline concentration. And then once, you know, the oil washed ashore or went to certain places, they could make measurements and they were prepared to say, stay there for weeks on end on these ships and keep making these measurements and keep collecting these time points.
And when you talk about sort of like oil leaks or oil seeps, are those from just general traffic into the Gulf of Mexico, or are they like natural seeps from the bottom of the ocean?
They're natural seeps from the bottom of the ocean, right? So oil is made because you took a bunch of organic material, i.e. like dead organisms, you know, like dinosaurs or whatever mass extinction had happened, and they all died and they got buried. And over time, they're like leftover, I guess, like debris or waste or whatever you want to call it, that got cooked down and it turned into oil, right? So that's like naturally exists on the earth. We extract that oil to then use it for industrial purposes. But those like oil, I can't remember what they're called, like reservoirs. Sorry, I wanted to say aquifer, but I'm like, no, that's not an aquifer. But those oil reservoirs typically often naturally will leak into the sea floor. So you could have a subsurface reservoir and there's, you know, migration of some oil. It's obviously not like a leak like what we saw with like a man-made oil spill where it's like gushing out, but it definitely leaks out. And so when microbes are exposed to oil in general, it's not super toxic to them. They're not like, oh my God, what are these compounds? A lot of them have the ability to eat these compounds. And so usually we actually see an increase in the density of microbes following an oil spill because it's really just a food source. Like the jury's still out. Like we don't know for sure because it's always with these things hard to say if it's one thing or the other thing. But certainly I don't think anyone who looked at that data or studied the data and looked at the Gulf of Mexico's like history of having these natural seeps can say that having those seeps didn't help stimulate or get that oil cleaned up more naturally. Does that make sense? Other people might argue that also the other things that made a difference in something like the Gulf of Mexico versus say the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska is the type of oil. The Louisiana oil was considered to be this like sweet oil that's very light. And what that means is it's very easy for microbes to eat that stuff. the compounds typically are smaller. And so it's like a very edible food source. It's like, you know, eating candy for microbes, for example. Whereas oil from, say, like the oil sands, that stuff is really difficult for microbes to eat just based on the chemical structure. And so something like oil sands oil is going to be very different than that Louisiana oil. So it's really hard to say, like, how much of it was, say, the composition of the oil versus like the fact that the Gulf of Mexico is really warm and microbes are very active, and also their prior exposure. It's probably like a Venn diagram of all of those things.
You talk about in the paper the light oil, when bacteria that can digest it starts to enter into the droplets, it becomes heavy and then turns into part of it, makes the
like marine snow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any studies or anything going on that you've caught wind of that has said how that affected the deep marine life in the Gulf of Mexico after that?
Oh, following the spill, there was some work that came out that was somewhat relevant, because you're essentially interested in terms of like toxicity from that spill, right? Going up the food chain. So one of the things, so a lot of that oil got degraded. Like, that's the general consensus, is that oil was rapidly degraded. Why was it degraded? Could have been prior exposure, you know, could have been these things I mentioned. One other thing they did during that spill that they'd never done before is they applied something called a dispersant. They applied this dispersant, corrects it. And what that does is it takes the oil and it turns it into smaller droplets. So it's actually easier for microbes to eat. And so that's another suggestion as to why that oil degraded really quickly, is that they applied this dispersant and that, like, you know, fixed it. They like just dumped it literally on the oil at the surface, is my understanding. But anyway, there was a study that came out a few years after the spill, and it actually suggested that that dispersant was very toxic to organisms higher up the food chain. Like, maybe it did help degrade the oil faster for the microbes, but like, it was also very toxic to these other organisms in that environment. Now, what would have been worse, like leaving the oil, like you said, the higher molecular weight fraction, letting that sink down, and we know that stuff is toxic, would that have been more toxic than this dispersant? That I don't know. I don't know what the consensus there seems to be, but I do know that there are questions about whether or not that dispersant that was used there actually did more damage, like, you know, did more bad than good, because it was shown to be toxic afterward to other organisms.
Okay. One other question that I had was sort of like expanding the scope of your research. So when you're talking about these oil spills and like these microbes that eat oil in a very specific environment, how can we sort of generalize that to a bigger picture? And what can we take out of your research to apply to maybe a different situation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we're doing a project right now in the Arctic Ocean, which is a ocean that's not very well studied in terms of what those microbes will do in response to oil. And by do, I mean like how quickly they'll eat up the oil and what those dynamics might be. And so, you know, like what we can do is take our understanding of what we know in, say, the Deepwater Horizon spill and some of the work I did and others did, and then take that understanding and think about, say, the Arctic Ocean, which is very important to Canada. So in Canada, we have a large part of the Arctic Ocean and land there. And as sea ice melts, that's becoming a primary shipping route. So we're expecting more and more ship traffic. And, you know, presumably that might lead to accidents where you might have an oil spill or an oil leak or some sort of accident where you have a large release of oil into the Canadian Arctic. And so as to how those microbes would respond, that's something we don't know. We don't know. So, for example, like I talked about dispersants, you're not allowed to use dispersants in the Arctic Ocean. The Canadian government doesn't allow it. So then it's a question of like, okay, how would, or how much oil could we expect to get degraded if the spill were to happen in the winter where there's sea ice cover? If there's sea ice cover, is the oil just going to get stuck onto the ice? Is any of it going to make it down? And if it does, like how much? And would you expect microbes on sea ice to eat the oil? Like, these are all outstanding questions versus the summer where there's no sea ice and maybe you might have some degradation. And so like understanding the extent to which microbes can help you clean up this oil in the Arctic can help the government and also communities there develop policies and protocols. So for example, if something were to spill in the winter, maybe you physically need to plan on removing the oil, like actually physically removing it, versus in the summer where you might just be able to wait for those microbes to naturally degrade it in something like, you know, the Gulf of Mexico scenario.
It's cool that a lot of sort of very technical research in the environment field has a very like policy oriented application. And yeah, to see sort of how research can interact with lawmakers and policymakers. One thing that that sort of reminded me of was you're a member of the Trottier Space Institute, as well as being part of the Earth and Planetary Science Department at McGill. How did you sort of become interested in space, and what was the path to starting research in that?
Like, I have a few projects that are space related and early Earth related. So for me, like thinking about life, like thinking about astrobiology, which is like thinking about life elsewhere, that also includes for me thinking about how life started on this planet and what the evolution of life was on this planet. Like, why does life look like what it does now? And did that trajectory that happen, is that going to happen in other places, right? Like, what are we going to look for? Are we looking just for microbes, or can we assume things will pan out like they did on here? When I do this kind of work, we're thinking about microbes in marine environments. A lot of that was always parallel to people that think about astrobiology, because thinking about in terms of life on other solar bodies, like even Mars, we know that there's no life on the surface of Mars, but one of the questions is, how deep does life go? And so, you know, we're looking at these marine samples and we're really interested in how does hydrothermal heating produce essentially energy sources for microbes? But thinking about microbes in these environments that are like 2.4 kilometers below the surface of our Earth is really important for thinking about like what environments are habitable and what are the limits of life. And so doing work in like deep marine environments sort of touches on and sort of sheds light on some of those ideas, right? It's like, what kind of microbes live in the bottom of the ocean where there's no light and it's dark? These are environments that we find in other places. And so I wouldn't say I really like sought it out. It's just that my, you know, this sort of research area, the deep biosphere is what it's often called, is very, very relevant for people that are searching for life in other places. Because, you know, there might not be life on the surface of Mars, but maybe there is life 10 meters below the surface in the sediment, kind of like on Earth. So when I came at McGill, I learned about the Trottier Space Institute and I interacted with colleagues there, and they were like, oh, some of your work is definitely relevant, that, you know, that you're doing is relevant to like habitability and thinking about sort of how life gets energy and carbon in these very sort of, you know, if you will, extreme environments. And so that's how I sort of got involved with it. And I joined it. And so, yeah, so I've got these various projects where we're looking, you know, at life in these, you know, deep, dark, if you will, extreme environments, as well as thinking about the evolution of life. How did, you know, life get to where it does? How did heterotrophs evolve to eat these different things? And then we also have a new project where we're looking at life in potentially life in ocean worlds, specifically Enceladus, and thinking about like, okay, if that ocean world does have organics and we were to sample the plume, what sort of organic patterns would tell us that microbes are there? Yeah, so it's really just because this environment that I'm working in is very related to looking for life in all these other places.
To me, space has always been like going forward versus going back, I guess.
I mean, going back is actually one of the key things, right? Because, for example, when they look at even the atmosphere of exoplanets, right? Like, and again, I didn't even know this because I'm not an astronomer, but in talking to all these people at the Space Institute and other people, they look for chemical signatures in their atmosphere as signs for life. What are those chemical signatures? They look for oxygen. Oxygen is considered to be this biosignature. And the reason oxygen is a biosignature is because like on our Earth, there was life on our Earth for like a few billion years. And then we had, you know, cyanobacteria develop the ability to do photosynthesis where they're producing O2. And so then you ask the question, okay, well, then you assume that if there is life on another place, it would evolve the ability to produce O2, which is a big assumption to make there. So even looking forward for life in these other places, so much of it is based on the chemical and molecular history of what has happened on our planet, which again, I didn't know about either till I started like talking to all of these people. And I was like, oh, I didn't know what we're basing it on all of these things.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess when you can't go back to sort of the inciting event of like what started life on Earth, you're pretty dependent on technologies that are evolving today. What do you think the next sort of technologies in your field are going to be? And how do you expect technologies that are used today to become more widely used?
You mean widely used in like society, or what more, or do you mean widely used in my our research field, or both? Maybe
both, if you have an answer.
Okay. So I think like sequencing is like the obvious one, right? So that project with oil spills, one of the aspects, it's like a really big project. It's not just me, right? It's like a ton of PIs across different institutions. And, you know, we're looking at microbes in the Arctic Ocean and thinking about which ones can degrade oil and how quickly. And the goal for that is to develop these genetic markers. And nowadays, you can buy a sequencer that fits in the palm of your hand for like $1,000. And the goal is that we are working, there's even social scientists on our team, working with local indigenous communities, and we will give them these sequencers and they can sequence microbes in the seawater and essentially give us that data if there is a spill, and we can tell them if there are signs of natural degradation of these oil compounds. So sequencing has like, you know, just exploded. It's gone from this thing that was like very expensive where you just had like, you know, the instruments in a few places. And now like we can literally for $1,000 buy a bunch and hand them out to local communities. So I think like that's an obvious one where it's becoming more publicly accessible. It's becoming cheaper. And I can see it being used in all of these different scenarios, right? I think in my field, like the thing that's really exciting is like to see where we go with, well, I would say like two things. One is like CRISPR and what we're going to be able to do with that. There's a lot of like excitement about that and whether, you know, we can use that to alter microbes in the environment or in mixed communities. You know, you could presumably do really exciting experiments in the lab that would save you lots of time, or even things in the environment. So I think like that's sort of the next frontier, is like applying this gene editing method to the environment. And then the other thing is like, I think all of the developments with AI are really exciting. Like, I'm not one of those people that's worried about AI like taking over or something. You know, there's all of these new AI programs that say predict what the structure of a protein is going to look like. Or, you know, I just feel like we're sort of just on the cusp of what AI can help us do in our research, right? It can save us so much time and so much money by taking all of this data and giving us suggestions as to what something might be or something might look like or that sort of thing. So yeah, so I think like an AlphaFold is this program that's come out in the last few years. That's a really good example of that. But yeah, I think like seeing what AI does for our field is very exciting. And then more broadly, like CRISPR as well.
The CRISPR stuff that you sort of mentioned is sort of more in our wheelhouse because we work with synthetic biology and gene editing is a big question for us. I was wondering if you guys make any ethical considerations when thinking about CRISPR or altering genomes of microbes, or potentially like introducing microbes to environmental situations.
I haven't done any CRISPR work myself, so I have no idea if there's like some sort of ethics protocol that you have to undergo to say release the microbes. I can tell you that gene editing microbes is not new, right? We've been doing it for a long time. It's just that CRISPR is much more robust and faster. And my understanding is it's like more specific. It's just an overall way better tool for doing it than doing like the old school molecular biology way. So from that, I don't think there's any ethical considerations because like I said, gene editing has been done for decades now. Lots of people do it. It's just, this is a better way of doing it. Now, in terms of releasing it to the environment, that I don't know. I know that you can, releasing microbes into the environment is not anything new. People actually do it for decontaminating an environment. So it's been used, but the reason they stopped doing it is because it just doesn't work very well. But there are instances where for certain contaminants that are like not like oil, but much more specific, like chlorinated compounds, you could work with companies where they will grow up large volumes of microbes that can eat chlorinated compounds, and you can apply that to your contaminated site. The success rates are not very good. I have no idea in those cases, like who you would have to get permission from to do it. Maybe if it's your site, you don't. But I think all of these things have always happened, right? And when we think about gene editing, like we have genetically modified foods, right? I don't know. I'm sure that, like once we get to applications that like I can't even fathom, like maybe something really interesting or really cool, or maybe like gene editing the gut microbiome of an endangered species, we might get to these things. But in general, we've been doing gene editing for so long, and we've also been releasing microbes into the environment in, you know, these various applications as well. So I think there's probably some framework there already.
As we get ready to move into space and all this different kind of stuff that's going on there with sequencing, pulling information from evolution in order to engineer bacteria that are more adaptable to specific environments in terms of space travel, what is the hands-on work that you think your field will be engaging in within the next 10, 15 years regarding this movement of microbes in space?
That's a really good question. So I think like in general, geomicrobiology and environmental microbiology can really help shed light on two different aspects of that. Number one, thinking about like these ocean worlds in our solar system, places like Titan, places like Europa, places like Enceladus, these are all also like Titan and Europa have missions coming up. Europa's mission is happening in October. Titan's got one in a couple of years, but all of these places where we'll get data back, I think that geomicrobiologists and environmental microbiologists, you know, I use the words interchangeably, they can really help shed light on those conditions for life as we know it, right? Would we expect to find life? What kind of life could we find? Because we've been studying these environments on Earth, right? We've been studying the ocean on Earth. So we can extrapolate that understanding to that. So I think like thinking about the habitability of these ocean worlds is sort of like where we could contribute. I also think that there are, you know, lots of people that study things like microbes, like cyanobacteria. These are microbes that are doing photosynthesis, you know, the ones that put O2 out. And I think that they also can make really large contributions to understanding how and why these metabolisms evolved and whether we would expect that they would evolve in other places. And, you know, what are the chances of us finding oxygen on all of these other places? And so, like, I think getting a better picture of why and how life evolved as it did, as well, specifically thinking in the context of like photosynthesis, which, you know, it completely changes the surface of a planet. If we found a planet that like, you know, had the vegetation red edge, which is due to like plants, it would be a really good sign that life is there. But the question is like, are we always going to get to photosynthesis if life evolves on a planet? Again, that's something where I think people that study microbes in the environment and specifically microbes that are carrying out photosynthesis can help us sort of like tease apart.
Right. So from what I'm understanding, it's that we're taking a combination of the fundamentals that we know about the evolution of metabolism and bacterial life and combining that a bit with the knowledge of bacteria that live in extreme environments in order to understand how life on these sort of more less developed planets can be understood and maybe discovered. So yes, we'll leave you with totally. a hard-hitting question at the end here. Based off current knowledge that you have, because you're working with one of the most in-depth fields in terms of discovery and identification of extraterrestrial life, what are your thoughts? Do you think that within the next 5-10 years, or based off evidence of now, what is your take? Do you think that there is life on some of these other planets, potentially in our solar system?
I definitely think there's life elsewhere in the universe. So that I'm like convinced of, because I just find it hard to believe that on our planet, life started so quickly after our planet was formed that you can't find these exact same conditions somewhere else just because there are so many planets. So I definitely think there's life in like in the universe. Whether there's life in our solar system, that I'm less sure about. We have all of these ocean worlds. They obviously don't have intelligent life. We would have found that. Do they have microbial life? Maybe. I have no idea. I don't think we'll find out in the next 5 to 10 years. I think realistically, we'll find out like during my lifetime, right? Because these missions, like when they send something out, it's like 7 years to get there. And then like, if we can get samples back, we're talking like 10 years before the samples get back. So I definitely think we'll have answers about life in our solar system, you know, during my lifetime. But there's also really exciting things happening with like space telescopes, like the James Webb Space Telescope. Nick Cowan, who's here in the physics department, is really involved with that. NASA is apparently also launching another telescope as well in the 2040s. And maybe we might actually find signatures for life outside of our solar system using these telescopes. I don't know enough about them and how you get the data back and that sort of thing. But the answer is like, I definitely think there's life out there. 5 to 10 years, maybe not. But I'm hoping like during my lifetime, we can see evidence for life elsewhere, whether that's like an atmospheric signature or whether that's some sort of signal from one of these ocean worlds.
Thank you so much. I know you have something else to get to, so we'll leave it there. But that was super interesting to learn about.
We'll definitely have okay. to do a meeting next time.
Totally. If
life found on that planet. See
how absolutely.
Feel the research totally. Side down.
Yeah. Thank you so much.